Just sit right back and you'll hear a tale of a fateful trip.
In the year 1831, biologist Charles Darwin began a fateful journey on the HMS Beagle. On that journey, Darwin formulated the controversial theory of evolution, which has impacted society down to this day.
Our goal is to punch holes in that theory, so we'd like to welcome you to
Sink the Beagle.
Fire one, Captain.
Way to go, Stan. Nice shooting, Rudy Toot shooting.
Thank you. And down goes the boat with the doggy and Charles Darwin with it. We hope, anyway. This is Stan Hudson.
And I'm John Krolinski, welcoming you to Sink
the Beagle,
where we take lighthearted looks at the serious issues of evolution and creation.
They are serious issues, but we don't know how to look at anything seriously. No, I mean without the light heart.
Without the light heart. Without a laugh a little bit, cry a little bit maybe. Who knows what it will be? Crying is heavy heart.
And none of us know. We can't predict a thing here on Sink the Beagle. We hope that we say things that are interesting and helpful for you as you try to understand the great questions of life, where we came from and where we're going. And today, John, what's the subject for
today? We're going to talk about big stuff, Stan.
Big stuff.
I am ready.
I'm ready.
Lots of parts.
Okay.
Lots of parts. So, you know, it's interesting. We kind of, a few weeks back, talked a little bit about Michael Behe. We kind of chastised a little bit of his desire to straddle the fences between science and faith.
Right.
I should put it that way. He takes faith. There's faith in science, but about God and materialism.
Right.
But reality is he brought forth this principle called irreducible complexity.
Irreducible complexity. And I'll bet you can't say that fast three times.
Doesn't matter. We're not going to try.
It doesn't. And this is a kind of a term that has caught on in this great evolution versus creation debate. It's been shot at a lot by evolutionists who feel like it's not a good argument, but not really particularly disproved yet, at least not to our satisfaction. But what about irreducible complexity?
Well, that's on the micro scale.
He's a microbiologist,
biochemist. He deals with the fine little complexities of a cell.
Okay.
And what happens here is that this term that we are going to talk about today is the other end of the scale, so to speak.
Okay.
In other words, we know that there are irreducibly complex systems that all have to be there. You can't have a partial eye or a partial ear. It has to either be there all at once or it never would function at all. On a subcellular or subsystem.
Yeah, it wouldn't be something that would be considered a help to help something be selected in nature. So, you know,
it would actually hinder evolution.
So,
what we want to talk about today, though, is irreducible interdependence.
Irreducible interdependence. Okay. You're talking about family systems?
No.
Okay.
Well, they could be too. But the point is this. So this is by Timothy Standish in a recent journal article in the magazine called Origins.
All right.
And Dr. Standish
points out that. And he's a microbiologist.
Yeah, he's a biologist as well. But he says, could it be that there are systems not on the microscopic, but the macro levels.
Okay.
In other words, we're talking in one example he uses, and we'll bring up others that we could throw out as well. One he uses is the nitrogen cycle. In other words, are there systems already in place that have to be there for life?
Okay.
That are so complex and so interdependent on other things that without them you don't have the cycle but you need them already working to even have life.
And too complex to be easily explained by randomness and chance.
That's
correct. To have happened.
And one of the ones he has chose is the nitrogen fixation cycle.
Okay.
Which is a real complex way you may have gotten in your high school biology, for sure in college biology or botany. But the point is that everything that's alive needs nitrogen.
Everything needs nitrogen.
We have a problem.
That's true. Three-quarters of the air that we breathe is nitrogen. All right.
But it's not easily accessible to us in a form that we need it.
Okay. How so?
Because we require a certain type of nitrogen, and it has to come in a way that we can receive it.
Okay.
It's like trying to eat a piece of cake only in bites of sizes that are as big as a bowling ball. I mean, you can't get it in your mouth. You got to break it up into smaller pieces.
I'd like
nitrogen
to try anyway.
Nitrogen has to change. Okay. And we see it. A common way of illustrating it is like when lightning strikes, you get a big thunder and lightning storm, your grass gets greener.
Okay.
Because the lightning and that whole thing helps trigger the release of nitrogen in a form that plants can use it, and it greens up your grass.
Weed
and it does
feed.
All this.
All right.
The same thing is true when you have animal waste. you know, animal excrement decaying in the ground and used by plants like legumes and stuff. And
manure,
they all do this
okay.
with ammonia and mm-hmm. other things. They all change one form of nitrogen into a usable form for the various plants and systems.
You're talking
well.
About nitrates and nitrites and all of that
all
kind
that
of stuff.
All that stuff, you know, it's beyond okay. me a little bit, but I understand enough to mm-hmm. know that we need it. And it has to go through some change for us to use it. And it's a very complex process. That's, any which step or any which part is missing, you don't get it.
And it's all very, very necessary for life.
And vital for life.
Okay. And the idea that these sorts of cycles, this nitrogen cycle, could just simply happen spontaneously in the way it has to serve. Okay. You're pressing the chances. You're rolling dice.
You're rolling
a little bit
the dice that have, they're so multi-sided. You have thousand-sided dice and
a bazillion to one chance.
And, and you have to roll two of them, you know, and you got the exact same number.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the odds are just astronomical.
Well,
We think there's other ones though, Stan. Just think about it for a minute.
Well, they're big systems and, you know, so many systems in place. For instance, let's talk about our good friend the moon. You know, they used to be a society in London in the days of Darwin called the Luna Society. And, you know, the free thinkers of the day were members of it. And, of course, from that membership came the title or the term lunatic. But anyway,
let's take a look at the moon.
Yeah.
How does the moon impact us?
Well, for instance, in our tides, of course, it's just perfectly placed in distance and gravitational power for the size of the planet. Circling the Earth, it's just perfectly placed to help with our tides, our ocean tides.
Mm.
And it kind of helps sweep water in and out, just enough pull to control the water movements of the oceans around the tidal areas. And it causes the tidal pools to live and to flourish.
And if you didn't have the tides, you would not have many species of life.
Well, a lot of life in the ocean would be affected, if not non-existent.
And some would say the oceans would be dead
mm-hmm.
if it wasn't for the tides. So
if that moon were closer or further, we wouldn't have that nice cycle.
And if you have a lot of your oxygen being produced by the algae in the ocean
mm-hmm.
and a fresh ocean and an ocean that's kept clean through these cycles,
mm-hmm.
you would not have, you know, there's so many things.
Yeah, so many things dependent upon it. Again, it seems to be irreducibly, you know, interrelated. There seems to be so many things involved in just the, you know, just the presence and the activity of the moon.
Yeah, and we could even throw into that one very, I think, cycle that people know is probably as big a miracle as anything if we want to look at it from a creationist perspective, otherwise the biggest lucky chance in the world, which scientists so crave, is the water cycle. They're trying to find water on the moon so they can say maybe life could be there. Maybe our theory isn't so stupid after all, which it is, we believe. But, you know, the water cycle where the streams, you know, the evaporation, you have condensation, you have mm-hmm. cloud formation, you have storm formation, you have the release of all that to form a cycle which nourishes and waters the earth. And without that rain, without that water, mm-hmm. without this cycle, you don't have life.
You don't have life.
And that includes, and that's vital also for the nitrogen cycle. And all these irreducibly interdependent things have to be in place for life.
Well, it's interesting that you just cited the water cycle as being one of these irreducibly interrelated systems, because God actually used that himself when he was talking to Job. In the book of Job in chapter 38, when Job was talking about whether or not God knew what he was doing in directing nature mm-hmm. and man's lives, God challenged Job to understand a little bit of how complex the universe is and how God was fully in control and fully mastering the systems and challenging Job to understand a little bit. And here he uses, as an example, the water cycle that you just talked about. Starting in verse 25 of Job 38, it says, and he's talking to Job, challenging him, "Who has divided a channel for the overflowing water or a path for the thunderbolt to cause it to rain on a land where there is no one, a wilderness in which there is no man, to satisfy the desolate waste and cause to spring forth the growth of tender grass?" Who's designed this?
Who put this complex system mm-hmm, together mm-hmm. to provide tender grass for wild goats in a deserty climate?
And he even said it's a place where there aren't any people, so it wasn't people working on it, buddy.
Hello, you didn't build the channels. You didn't put the cycle together.
This is not a man-made thing. And this is just one of many, many systems that you could call, you know, irreducibly interrelated.
And and combined with that, you can throw in the principles of the natural law. We call them natural, but they're actually still God's laws of gravity and the rotation of the earth at just the right speed. The place, if you want to look at it in a sense on the very macro level, here you have a sun of a certain size and you have its satellites being the planets, and you happen to be have an earth that is going around this sun at just the right distance.
93 million miles.
Just not, not too close, not too,
too close.
Far.
Right.
Otherwise there would be no life. And you have all this. I mean, even astrologically there seems to be irreducible interdependence between the moon, the right moon to help us stay in this gyroscopal spinning.
How about the rotation of the earth being just enough to compensate for gravity? Otherwise, we just crunch into the core, you know, to having enough of that spin.
Too much would fling us off.
Fling us off. Some of us do get flung off occasionally. But anyway, all of these areas seem to indicate something that has been a growing observation by scientists, even secular scientists, John, even those that don't have a bent towards creation. It's something that's called the anthropic principle. The anthropic, and it comes from the word anthropos, which in Greek means man.
Yeah.
And so it looks like to just the casual observer, boy, are we lucky.
Yeah.
The earth seems to be perfectly deformed. To supply man with all the things he needs for life.
What you call it, the anthropos?
Anthropic
purple. I call it the three bears.
Oh, the three bears.
Not too hot, not too cold, just right. You know,
just right for mankind.
Not too hard, not too soft, just right. You know, you have the three bears particular, and that's really wow. And when you look at even the human body, that David says in the Psalms, where I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. I just happen to be put together just right.
Yeah. Well, you.
Well, I'm getting most of the parts are still in pretty good shape.
Yeah,
at least they were.
Fine.
Got all the digits.
Well, you know, and again, Tim Standish, Dr. Standish has brought up a very interesting point, and that is that, like in the nitrogen cycle, there's a whole lot more to the subject than Michael Behe has revealed to us in his book. There are lots of systems that are irreducibly complex and irreducibly interrelated that seem to suggest design. And in the design, there's a suggestion of a designer.
And when you put them all together, you can't say which one can you leave out. Mm-hmm. And when you start going down this short list, you marvel at the complexity, the evolution, the probability of it happening, slight changes, modifications over time, just could not occur because too much stuff, there's too many things that have to be present. Science can't even begin to crunch in all the plausible things that are so vital that they're even unaware of that, you know, if we were missing this thing, we'd all be dead.
Well, it kind of requires faith to believe that all of this is just out of random chance and luck of the draw. And listeners, we just like to suggest to you, if you're going to have faith, and you are in some system, some worldview,
whether it be scientific or religious.
Yes, or religious, believing in God, we'd like to suggest to you that you place your faith into a God that believes in you as well and has made a beautiful world complex, irreducibly complex.
And he sustains it, holds it up, keeps it running.
It's for you, and it is the best imaginable place for God to have you right now.
So tune in again to another
Sink the Beagle.
Thanks for listening to Sink the Beagle. We'd like to send you a special gift just for being with us today. Write to our email address, beagle@lifetalk.net, and ask for your free copy of Dr. Dwight Nelson's book called Built to Last, A Thoughtful Look at Creation and Evolution. Ask for Built to Last when you write to beagle@lifetalk.net. And be sure to listen in next time to another episode of Sink the Beagle.
So join us here each week, my friend. You're sure to get a smile from seven stranded castaways here on Gilligan's Isle.